Hi, I'm Nathan Ryder, and welcome to the Viva Survivors podcast, where I talk to PhD graduates about their research, their Viva, and life after the PhD. This is episode 54, and today I'm talking to Dr. Fiona Noble, who finished her PhD at the University of Aberdeen in 2015. Fiona's PhD looks at post-Franco-Spanish cinema. It was really interesting to hear her talk about this, as well as talking about how she prepared for her Viva and what happened on the day. It's really great to welcome Fiona to the podcast today. So, hello, Fiona.
Hi there.
To begin with, can you tell us a little bit about the research that you did and maybe also how you ended up doing that PhD?
Yeah, sure. So my PhD is in Hispanic Studies and Film and Visual Culture from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. I focused in the PhD on Spanish cinema in particular, and I looked at the representation of three key figures in post-Franco Spanish society. So I looked at the child, the performer and the immigrant through a series of case studies. And I thought particularly about how these figures were particularly good examples of marginalised or invisible sectors of society. So the idea is that with post-Franco Spain, there was this freedom and celebration and liberty after years of dictatorship. And I wanted to show that there were areas in which these issues were still pertinent in the contemporary democratic Spain that we know today. And I guess the motivation or the inspiration for this came throughout my undergraduate and postgraduate studies at the University of Aberdeen, where I first discovered the cinema of Pedro Almodóvar, and I think everyone falls in love with him when they first see his work. And I started working on him in second year in my undergraduate degree and decided that Spanish cinema was the area that I was most interested in and kind of pursued that right the way do my academic career. And I was very much influenced by the work that I did in the postgraduate qualification on visual culture in the fields of queer theory and subaltern identities and thinking through what it means to be marginalised or invisible and how cinema in particular can play a key role in making visible those invisible sectors of society.
When you talk about post-Franco cinema, is there a particular period that you were looking at for this, or is that literally everything since that time?
I guess the term is definitely up for debate, in the sense that I actually expanded the boundaries of post-Franco Spain, because Franco died in 1975 and I did include a couple of films from just before his death, so one from 1973 and one from 1975 prior to his death. So I did play with this idea of what post-Franco Spain actually was, and thinking about how the transition from dictatorship to democracy did have its roots in Francoist Spain, if you like, before Franco died. And so it was mainly focused on post-1975 cinema, right up to, I think, 2010 would have been the most recent film that I looked at. So it spans the contemporary democratic period in Spain, the films that I look at.
Okay, and so for people who perhaps don't watch, I was about to say world cinema, but I suppose I mean, you know, if people generally just go down to their local cinema or just find whatever's on Netflix or on TV, what sort of films are you thinking about then, or what sort of directors?
Sure. So I have quite a broad span of films that I deal with in the PhD. So I work with quite canonical filmmakers in the Spanish context. I appreciate that, you know, Spanish cinema is one that we don't know a lot about in Britain. It's not one that's featured regularly in, like you say, the local duplex, Cineworld and these kind of places. And even on Netflix, it's really poorly represented. So I do think that we need, and again, this goes back to visibility and marginalisation, because the themes that are related to the figures in the thesis, so the child, the performer and the immigrant, also apply to the films that I study.
Right.
I have films like, I guess, the more familiar films in there for people who are not so au fait with Spanish cinema would be the likes of Guillermo del Toro's The Devil Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth, which are quite well known beyond the framework of Spanish cinema, I guess. I've got one in there from Pedro Almodóvar, who's, again, probably the most famous Spanish filmmaker beyond Spanish borders. And I have, what else do I have? I have Beautiful by Alejandro González Iñárritu, who he directed Babel and also most recently Birdman, which won the Oscar last year. And so there are figures in there who are relatively well known beyond the field of Spanish cinema scholarship. But then there's also some films in there that are much more obscure. So, for example, I look at a film called Amador by Fernando León de Aranoa. And León de Aranoa is quite a well-known filmmaker. In fact, his most recent film had Benicio del Toro in it, but I haven't actually seen it yet. And that film is one that I've not found anything that anyone's written about it. So I really tried to kind of bring diverse works together that span a broad range of genres, a broad range of filmmakers, both canonical and not so well known, to try and make the point that actually that Spanish cinema itself is marginalised and is invisible in the contemporary context.
When you sent through some of your details about your research in advance of the podcast, I was thinking, because like a lot of films that I watch are generally, you know, British or American. But a couple of years back, I suppose it was during my PhD, actually, I had an interest in trying to expand my horizon, sounds wrong, but you know, to try and see films from other cultures.
Yeah.
And I watched a lot of French films. I watched a few Japanese films, some, you know, Hong Kong, you know, Chinese films as well. But very few Spanish films, because they're not from not wanting to watch them, but because they weren't accessible.
No.
And I think the only one I have seen Pan's Labyrinth, but the only other Spanish film that I could really think of that I'd seen was Intacto.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. And I was able to see that at the cinema when it was released, but mm-hmm. I really couldn't tell you any other films that came through Liverpool, where I lived at the time, mm-hmm. At the cinema. And we have like a fairly decent independent cinema in Liverpool as well.
Yeah, I think it's quite an interesting one, and I think it's a problem that that spans not just cinema but also academia as well, because I think there's an assumption that culture, I mean, the humanities obviously are quite in a quite a difficult place at the minute anyway, and because we have to justify the research that we do in terms of impact and dissemination and all these kind of things that are very in at the minute in academia, public engagement and whatnot. I think obviously we have to defend ourselves as arts and humanities scholars anyway, and I think within that there's another kind of hierarchy of you know, what's seen as the most important and what's seen as less important. And I think there is a historical preference for French culture, for example, over Spanish culture, that French culture is regarded, you know, and I'm not saying I subscribe to this, but, you know, I think it is a problem. And I think we don't know a lot about Spanish cinema in the UK. You know, I absolutely agree with you that even, like you say, even in independent cinemas, the number of Spanish films that we get access to is very limited. But I think actually that problem, you can see it in Spain itself. People in Spain don't generally go to the cinema to watch Spanish films. They typically go to watch Hollywood blockbusters that have been translated or dubbed into Spanish rather than watching Spanish films. And actually one of the recent films that's kind of turned this whole framework on its head is called Ocho Apellidos Vascos, and the sequel, which has just come out, Ocho Apellidos Catalanes. So they would translate literally as eight Basque surnames and then eight Catalan surnames. But quite interestingly, the English translation of Ocho Apellidos Vascos is a Spanish affair, because it's all about the regional dynamics in Spain and all about the kind of stereotypes of regional identities. So it's very specific to Spain, and that proves very difficult to translate. So this film, Ocho Apellidos Vascos, completely smashed any box office takings for Hollywood films in Spain the year it was released, 2014. And Ocho Apellidos Catalanes is currently in cinemas and taking a lot of money. But obviously it's not really exportable because it's so culturally specific. And it's a comedy as well, which I think you know, there's a whole conversation that you could have there about humour and how humour is culturally specific and difficult to translate across borders sometimes. But yeah, I think actually the problem, I mean, obviously in the UK we don't get a lot of access, but I think also there's a deeper problem in that, you know, even within Spain, Spanish people are not typically going to the cinema. And that is related to a whole load of issues. But one of the most important is financial or economical. You know, the Conservative government has completely decimated the culture industry in Spain with their tax cuts and not tax cuts, sorry, tax increases and, you know, unfair policies to do with culture and cultural productions. It's actually very difficult to realise a film in Spain. But yeah, so I feel like I'm maybe getting on my soapbox here a little bit with this. But, you know, I think it comes back again to this question of marginality and invisibility and, yeah, the need to spread awareness about Spanish cinema, because it's really good, you know.
Yeah. What were the big highlights then of your thesis then, in terms of, I suppose, the either the results that you found or these questions or the ideas that you've raised through your thesis? What stands out?
I think maybe one of the most interesting things for me was that I started out with a very clear idea of not what I wanted to do, but rather what I didn't want to do. And I don't know if that's something that everyone goes through, but, you know, I started out by saying, okay, I'm going to look at the child and how the child's represented in post-Franco Spanish cinema, but I don't want to look at the Del Toro films. I don't want to look at, you know, these films where the child is used in the historical setting of the Civil War, because I was very skeptical. I thought, you know, the child is being deployed here as an emotional device. It's being used in a manipulative way to make the audience think, oh, look at these bad guys in the war. And, you know, I was really kind of skeptical and critical about the Del Toro films and other films that are similar, like The Butterfly's Tongue, Secrets of the Heart's another one. There's a whole host of them that use the child in this kind of wartime setting. And, you know, I find it kind of very manipulative, and I wasn't interested in looking at these films. But actually, as I began to research and I began looking at lots of different films and reading about, you know, theoretical frameworks of understanding the child and the representation of the child, I started to think about, okay, well, there is this layer of manipulation. There is this layer of, well, the child's innocent and they can see right from wrong. They can see the truth and so on. But also there was something more interesting going on behind that. So I think, yeah, in terms of highlights, I think that the way in which research can make you completely change how you think about something, whatever it is you're researching, I think for me was one of the most interesting components. I think, I don't know if that's a very good answer, but I think, you know,
that's great.
Yeah, it you know, it's not a particularly interesting result in terms of research, but I think more about the process and how that changes you and the way that you think and what you're interested in, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think it's really worth reflecting on. And obviously, I've had a couple of people on the podcast before who've really, when they think about their research, the highlight or the thing that stands out is this change. And I think it's not remarked upon enough, really, that the person who, when you complete a PhD, you are a different person from when you began. And really? Yeah, like you say, even in terms of maybe what the goal was, or even the idea of the goal was for your research when you started.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with that. I think it does transform you, and it does make you see things in a new light. And I think even, you know, since completing the PhD, I look back at it now and I think, oh, you know, I'm not sure if I actually would argue that now. You know, so I think, yeah, that process of changing as a researcher and learning how to formulate ideas and opinions and then to completely turn that on its head. I remember there was a great conference paper I saw a few years ago when I was kind of in the early stages of the PhD, and this, you know, really, really respected academic in Hispanic studies sat there and she said, you know, in previous articles I've argued X, Y and Z about this film, but today I'm going to argue against that completely. And it was actually Pan's Labyrinth she was talking about as well.
Right.
And I find that so refreshing that you could actually say, well, you know, in this article, I suggested that this was the case, but today I'm going to say that the complete opposite is the case. And I think that realizing that we're humans, you know, we're not robots producing research paper after research paper, that we're humans and we can change our ideas about things actually is I don't know, it's quite enlightening, I think, and quite refreshing.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you for sharing some of your research. I want to turn now to thinking about the Viva. So if memory serves, your Viva was it June this year?
It was, yes.
So I suppose, what were you doing on the run-up to the Viva? Did you have a long time between submission and the big day?
Yeah, I had about 4 months or so between submission and the Viva, and that was because of commitments that my external examiner had. So that was the soonest that we could arrange the Viva for. And, you know, I submitted at the end of January earlier this year, and June felt like such a long time, you know, after submitting. But actually, it was really good because it forced me to take a proper break from the thesis and really take some time away from it. And, you know, I had other projects on the go. So I had an edited book manuscript that was due to the publishers. So I was working on that kind of immediately after submitting the PhD. I also then went to a conference in April. So I worked on the conference paper. And I really didn't think about preparing for the Viva until after I came back from that conference. So that would have been, you know, the end of April, beginning of May. So I really only spent about a month prepping for the Viva. And during that time, I was also working and doing other things. So it wasn't like it was a full-time job prepping for the Viva in that month. But I did spend, you know, a considerable amount of time preparing for the Viva in that month, like I say, between kind of the beginning of May and the beginning of June when it took place.
Okay. And so what sort of things did you do to prepare for your Viva?
I did a mixture of things. You know, so I started off, I compiled kind of in the final stages of the thesis, so kind of the editing, I'd compiled a list of sources that I wanted to go back and revisit in preparation for the Viva. So that included things like, for example, I mentioned a few films in passing, you know, in a footnote, where I hadn't actually analysed them in the thesis, and some of them, you know, I maybe had only seen little sequences from, or, you know, bits of. I hadn't actually seen the whole film. So I had a whole list of films that I wanted to go back and watch, just in case there were any questions about, okay, well, you know, you've made this framework about the child, but how would it relate to these other films that you've not mentioned, or that you've only mentioned in a footnote? So, you know, I had that list, and I, you know, I spent some time watching some films. And actually that proved quite useful because it gave me some material for my blog as well. You know, I could write up a little film review for the blog, and that kept me kind of in the process of writing as well, which I think is always good to keep going after you've finished the thesis. And I also did some reading. So I had, again, a list of material, reading material that I wanted to go back to. So that might have been theoretical works that were published very close to my submission date, so I didn't have time to really deal with them in depth prior to submitting, but that I wanted to be able to discuss in the Viva if I needed to. So I went back and I did some reading, and that was kind of how I introduced my Viva prep. And I just kind of, you know, got myself in gently by reading and thinking and watching. And then I think after that I tackled reading the thesis again. And it probably took me a couple of weeks to really read the thesis through in quite a bit of detail. And, you know, I took notes. I'm a bit of an obsessive note taker. So I had a humongous Word document where I had basically outlined every single point that I had made in the thesis. And I had a really clear idea in my head of the structure of my argument and the different points that supported the arguments I was making. And I used a lot of post-its as well, because I'm also a bit of a post-it fiend. So the thesis was all marked up with post-its and bits underlined and whatnot. And then I also, probably the third kind of major thing that I did was practice Viva questions. So I compiled a list of questions that I thought I might be asked, and I practiced answering those just on my own, in my little study with a dictaphone, so that I could listen back to what I'd said. And really it was about practicing articulating my ideas clearly and succinctly, and trying not to get myself in knots when I was answering those. So yeah, I think those are probably the three major things that I did in that month leading up to the Viva.
Okay. It sounds like it was a It sounded like quite a thorough preparation. How were you feeling after you'd done that?
I think I was okay in the sense that I had done a lot of preparation. And so, you know, I knew my thesis inside out, and I was confident going in the sense that, you know, I knew my examiners and they know my work, and I felt like, you know, I should be confident. But I think at the same time, you really don't know what to expect. And I was really, really nervous because, you know, you can't predict what they're going to ask you and how they're going to ask you. And I think everyone has this irrational fear that maybe you're going to go blank in the middle and you're going to think, I can't remember, you know. And I had a mock viva with my supervisor, and she did such a nice job of reassuring me that I should be confident, and that, and, you know, if it doesn't all go to plan, that's okay. If you go blank, you can take a moment. And she said, you know, if you feel like you want to take a minute, look out the window and think about your answer before you actually answer it. That's okay, because, you know, this is not, it's not a test of how quick you can think on your feet. You know, it's about they're going to be asking you really difficult questions, you know, that will challenge you, and it will make you think about how you've laid out your thesis and how you've structured it and how you've used the theory and whatnot. And it's okay to take a minute and think. But I think we have this panic that we have to answer right away, or that we might not, it might not look like we've actually produced the work, which obviously is one of the things that they're checking with the viva. So I think it was a bit of a mixed bag of feelings, really, because on the one hand, I felt confident. I had the time to prepare. I'd had the distance from it as well, which was really crucial. But at the same time, it was that kind of unexpectedness of what is this actually going to entail, because it's such a singular experience. You know, in your own life, and also just what else could you compare it to? Maybe your driving test, you know, where you don't know what's going to come up on the day and you just have to kind of go with the flow and see what happens. Maybe that's a really bad comparison, but I think probably that was similar nerves as to the day of my driving test, maybe.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a bad comparison. I mean, I've heard the Viva compared to a lot of things. That's the first time for a driving test, but I can see where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also really, I think it's really great that you mentioned being able to take time to think. With the workshops that I do, and I talk to people, I say, you know, it's okay to take a pause. And it probably, when you take a break, to take a second to think, it's probably not even as long as you think it is. It might feel like it's a really long time, but it's been 2 seconds. And still, as I say that and I look out at the room, I can see like half a dozen people looking at me like, but no, surely I've got to answer. I've got to know everything. I've got to be able to talk immediately. And it's just wrong.
Yeah.
it's just really wrong. So thank you for sharing that on the podcast, because I think that'll be really useful for people to hear somebody else say it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can't remember in the Viva if I actually did that. But I think just knowing that you could do that, that you could, you know, take charge of the situation and say, okay, do you mind if I just pause and think about that for a second? You know, that's okay to do that, because I think, you know, like I say, we do maybe feel that there's this compulsion to speak. And like you say, it will feel, I always think of it as being like in tutorials, you know, and you're waiting for students to answer a question. And I know that when I first started teaching, I probably jumped in too quickly, you know, ask a question and it feels like there's been this really long pause before anyone says anything. But actually, like you say, it's probably been like 2 seconds, 3 seconds, maybe 5 at the most. And I think one of the things I've learned in my teaching practice, which I think probably would come in useful in the Viva experience as well for some people, is to you know, count to 5 in your head and wait before you actually start to speak. And I think that can actually teach you, you know, that the, I don't know, that there's a function there with that silence. And so the students are taking a moment to respond because they're thinking about their answers, just like we are in the Viva.
So moving on to the Viva itself then, how did it start? And did the start of the Viva, I guess, meet your expectations?
Yeah, I think so, in the sense that, you know, I came into the room and they said, you know, make yourself comfortable, get a glass of water and whatnot. And, you know, I sat down and they asked me a kind of very generic question to start with. And I think it was something along the lines of, what motivated you? I have my notes here, actually. I'm just going to double check.
Okay.
Yeah, so they said, yeah, what motivated you to study Spanish cinema in particular? And, you know, what motivated you to study the three topics? So the child, the performer, and the immigrant that I mentioned at the start. So they kind of, yeah, they asked me about that. And they asked me then about cinema as a medium and its significance with regard to the research that I do. And then also about the selection of sources that I use. So why I use the films that I used in the thesis. So, you know, I had those kind of three questions initially and, you know, I answered them. And then I remember that my external examiner then started speaking about a topic that I hadn't discussed or that I'd only mentioned in the conclusion. And I think it was at that point that I suddenly realised, because he was chatting away and he talked for quite, it felt like a really long period of time. I don't think it was. I think in my head it felt like a long period because I was expecting question and then me to answer, question and then me to answer. But he kind of elaborated on what he was asking. And I think at that point I suddenly realised I wasn't nervous anymore. You know, my nerves had just completely gone because, you know, I was sitting there and, you know, they were saying all these really interesting things about the work that I'd done and how I could make it even more interesting and the bits I really liked and the bits that they thought maybe needed a bit of work. And, you know, it didn't feel intimidating or like it was an interrogation. It just felt like a conversation between people who were interested in the work that I'd done. And that was amazing because I was like, oh, you know, like I thought this stuff only interested me, you know, and suddenly there's all these people who, you know, are really respected in your field who are saying, you know, this is really great and you could do this and you could take it this way. And it just felt like this really great conversation. And rather than a kind of one way interrogation, it was more like a mutual interest in what you were doing. And yeah, so it was quite strange in a way because I had expected to be nervous throughout the whole experience. But that few questions in, and I suddenly thought, oh, I'm not nervous anymore. Like, this is just actually really enjoyable. And it's a cliche. And so many people said to me, you're going to enjoy it. And I didn't believe them. I just thought, how am I going to enjoy this? This is going to be horrendous. So I think that kind of realization for me was like, oh, OK, this is actually quite fun. And, you know, there's no need to be so nervous. And yeah, I just felt totally at ease.
Well, that's really great to hear. Were there any parts where, despite your nerves sort of completely disappearing, were there any questions that really did make you pause? Or do you just remember, I suppose, being in the flow?
Yeah, I think it was quite fluid, really. Like I actually can't really remember a lot about it. And I have quite detailed notes that I took during the Viva, which I've gone back to quite a few times. And, you know, I've got them right in front of me just now. But It was quite fluid and quite relaxed, and it didn't feel like it lasted as long as it lasted. I think it was probably about 2 hours in total, but that's including, you know, the little break when you go away and they have a little chat and then come back. So it was probably about 90 minutes at least that we spoke for initially, and it just did not feel like that. It did not feel as long as 90 minutes. I don't think there was any questions that really, really troubled me because I think I'm quite open to new ideas and thinking about how I can improve my work. I think, you know, I don't know, again, if it's a general trait across academia, but I'm quite critical of my own work. And so I think, you know, if somebody says, oh, I think you should do this instead, I'm quite open to that. So I think it didn't feel, you know, even when they asked me, okay, well, why did you do this? Why didn't you do it this way? I didn't feel like I had to really staunchly defend what I was doing. I felt like I could be quite open and honest and say, okay, well, this was why I did it this way, but I, you know, take on board the point you're making about this. So yeah, I don't think there were any questions in particular that I really, really struggled with. And they were all quite specific to, oh no, do you know what? There was one actually. There was one in particular where they asked me about my use of Derrida and spectrality in the immigrant chapter. And they felt that, because obviously Derrida's quite a tough theoretician to get involved with, and you can't kind of use him superficially and not engage properly. So they were slightly critical of that. And also I used Foucault's concept of heterotopias as well, and they also felt that I needed to engage more with that at the level of theory. So I probably struggled a little bit with that. But, you know, that's so specific to what I was doing. It wasn't a particularly awful question. It was just about, okay, you need to think about this and develop it and engage with it a bit more. But that criticism as well was not really so much about the thesis and the corrections that I might need to do. It was more, and it was framed in this way, if you're taking this forward for publication, you might want to think about what you're doing with this. And I think that as well puts you at ease, because you think, okay, they're not saying that this has major flaws in terms of getting past the viva. They're just saying that you want to think about the theoretical frameworks if you're taking it further.
Yeah. Before I ask you about the very end of the viva and we move on from there, I just wanted to pick up, you mentioned taking quite detailed notes in the viva. Was that something that you'd planned to do? I think you mentioned already actually that you do take notes and keep notes and things quite regularly, but was this something that you would go into the viva specifically and it was something you were specifically going to do?
Yeah, I think this was advice that I got from one of my friends who had done her viva a couple of years previously, and you know, we were chatting about the viva. She actually gave me a mock viva as well, and she, I remember she pulled out, I don't even remember it was when we were talking about the viva, but there was one time I was around at her house and she pulled out these notes that were from her viva. You know, she still had the kind of original notes that she'd taken in the viva. And she said, you know, have a look at them. It was when I was prepping, actually, because she said, have a look at them and you can see what they asked me. And her notes were very coherent, actually, you know, although she said, I can't remember exactly what I was thinking when I was writing all of these down. And I think, so it was her advice. And also, I think from having done academic interviews, one of the pieces of advice that you often see is that you should write down the questions that you're asked as you're asked them, because then it gives you, if you suddenly realise you're rambling, it gives you something to look at to say, OK, this is actually what they were asking me, so I need to get back to this. And it's something that I actually hadn't really done in academic interviews up to that point. And I wanted to try and write things down, because I thought this is going to feel like a blur afterwards, and I want to have a record of what happened so that I can go back to it and remember. And I think like I say, I've gone back to those notes quite a lot, because we talked a lot about you know, not just about what I needed to do to complete the PhD, but also what I could do going forward. So, you know, I did take quite detailed notes, and I did, yeah, I think that was something that I planned to do. And I mean, looking back at them now, some of them don't really make much sense. But I think at the time as well, it's kind of a security thing, because you can write down what they're asking you. And like I say, it just gives you that handle. If you do suddenly lose your place and realise, hang on, I've gone on a tangent here, you can look back, okay, they were asking me about this, and it just gives you a bit of grounding. But I appreciate that it's not to everyone's taste to do that. I think it depends on how you work. It definitely worked for me.
Yeah, that's really great to hear. And again, this is another little tangent that I'll probably cut, but again, this is something that I talk about with people in workshops, mm-hmm. and I'll see all these incredulous faces, like, oh, won't your examiners think that you're stalling? Won't your examiners, you know, think that it's really odd that you're taking a pause to think, or that you're taking, mm-hmm. or that you're writing something down, or, you know, maybe you're not giving them enough attention. And I don't know why. I don't know why it's such a difficult concept for people to, I get, like you say, it may not be to somebody's taste, mm-hmm. or, but it, I don't understand when I've shared this with people in the past, why it seems like such a problematic thing for people to consider.
I think I maybe said to them, do you mind if I take notes? You know, when they were asking the first question, I think I maybe said, do you mind if I take notes? Because I think, again, that's something that you see with academic interview advice things, that it tends to say, you know, ask the question. And I think, you know, maybe that piece of advice would put people's mind at ease.
Yeah.
You know, who are preparing for viva, that actually, well, you know, ask the question. I mean, who's going to say, no, you can't take notes? Nobody's going to respond to say that. You know, so, but at least if that makes you feel more comfortable, I think, you know, we take notes in so many different settings, especially in the academic world. You know, it's kind of a norm. So I think people almost expect it. But yeah, I think, yes, yeah. It's interesting that you say that that's the reaction that people give you, because I think I just probably had assumed that that's what everyone would do. But I think just asking the question of, do you mind if I write this down, and that just covers you, you know, because you've asked permission, you've said that's what you're going to do, and you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all.
No. So coming to the end of the fiver, then, you said that your fiver was maybe around the 90-minute mark, mm-hmm. then there was a small break. Mm-hmm. You went back in. What was the result?
So I passed with minor corrections. Okay. You know, they said, congratulations, Dr. Noble, that's you. You've passed. And they said that, you know, they could have given me no corrections, but what they wanted to do was make sure that, because this piece of work, especially nowadays, the, you know, PhD theses are available, people can access them and they're downloadable and whatnot. So they were like, they wanted me to have the best thesis possible on the library catalogue available for download. But they urged me not to spend too much time on the corrections, which was kind of a nice consolation, I guess. You know, that you don't need to take 3 months to do this. It's not going to take you 3 months. So they talked a little bit more about what I needed to do. Obviously, I'd already kind of touched on that in the viva itself. And then we also talked about, they asked me if I had any questions as well. And we talked about, future paths, plans for publication and whatnot. And then it kind of devolved into more of an informal chat as well, you know, where we just chatted about other things relevant to the field and what we're interested in and so on. So yeah, it was really kind of relaxed and informal, and yeah, really nice way to end the discussion.
That's really great to hear. It's always nice when it's such a nice thought as well, you know, we want you to, there aren't many corrections, we want you to do them just so that this is the best it can possibly be.
Yeah, definitely. I think I probably took longer on them than I should have, because I started, you know, when I started looking at their list of corrections that they'd given me, and, you know, I started thinking, okay, well, I could just read this and, you know, I can work on this a little bit more. And, you know, I almost started getting back into this kind of researcher mode again to do with the thesis, which was really nice, because I think, you know, at the end of it, as much as you still enjoy what you do, like, I was like, oh, I don't want to ever see this thesis again. I, you know, I've got all these other new projects I want to do instead. So actually, it was really good, because it totally revived my interest in my research again, having had this conversation during the viva with my examiners about, you know, what this piece of work could be and what I could turn it into. And especially because actually, so the chapter that I thought was the weakest, they thought was the strongest. So, you know, it totally changed my perspective on my own work. And, you know, I got back into researching again, and my friend, the same one that I was talking about before, said to me, why are you taking out more materials from the library? You know, she said, you shouldn't be doing any more reading at this point. Like, you just need to do the corrections and submit it and move on, you know? So I wonder if psychologically I wanted to hold on to it a little bit, and just keep it, you know, as my little baby for a little bit longer before I let it go off into the world of the library. It kind of forced me, it was my friend who said, no, like, just get this done and submit it and move on. So yeah, it was a strange kind of feeling, because that was it, definitively over, and follows a sense of relief and, you know, this newfound freedom that you can now do whatever you want. And you also kind of miss, well, I speak for myself, I also miss the security of the PhD and, you know, the sense of knowing what I was doing and where I was going and what the aim was, because it, you know, in the last few months it's been a bit of an unknown. So yeah, I think it's a weird kind of phase to be in, I think.
Yeah, I remember it feeling very odd not to have something to do. Mm-hmm. Like, you may have work or something like that, but this, like, the PhD is such a, it's this big thing, and then it's not there.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the things I wanted to mention before we sort of wrap things up, I wanted to, pick up on the thread of blogging a little bit, because there have been a couple of people in the past who I've invited onto the podcast or got in touch, and they've maybe written a blog post about their viva, which is really great. It's really great that people do that. You've written three. And they're really big as well. They're really detailed in terms of the, I think one's on the preparation, one's on the day itself.
Yeah.
And then the others, the last one's sort of a reflective post, isn't it? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of a go-to advice bit where I've got, you know, like a little bibliography, a list of questions and things. So it's kind of, a checklist that people can use if they're prepping.
So what, so you're done with your PhD. Why spend so much time on that? That's not much sounds sort of facetious, but you've put together a really great little, it's almost like a small book, mm-hmm. really, for people to go to. Why spend the time on that?
I guess there's probably two reasons. I think on the one hand, it was to keep a record of what I felt doing the Viva, because I think, you know, like I said to you earlier, you know, it goes by in such a whiz that you can't remember everything. And I think I wanted to preserve in some sense the way that I felt and what I did and, you know, how I prepared for a personal reason, you know, that because I think, I mean, that's one of the great things I think about blogging. You know, I forget what blog posts I've written and what I've written about. And, you know, I use it as a tool to develop my thinking. So if I'm struggling with something in particular, I try and write a blog post, because then it gives you this record of what you're working on, the difficulties as well as the findings that you're coming up with. And that is such a good tool when you then look back and think, okay, right, I'm going to do an article on this, or, you know, I'm going to use this in one of my courses that I'm teaching. And, you know, like I do it all the time when I'm like, oh, have I written something on this? And go back and check the blog and I find this blog post that, you know, is actually really useful. And I think, oh, okay, I can take these ideas forward. So I think, yeah, on the one hand, it was about personal preservation and, you know, how I felt and what I did and so on. And then on the other hand, you know, I think the work that you do and, you know, there's others as well, I think, who, you know, who've written about the Viva and it's people's experience of it and so on. I think, you know, it's really inspiring because it is something that we don't talk about a lot, you know, and I appreciate it's because Vivas are so different across the board that there's not necessarily a set way that you can prepare, or, you know, a Viva's not going to take the same format for lots of different people. So it can be very difficult to talk about, but actually we do, that doesn't mean we can't talk about it. You know, we still need to talk about it. And I found it quite intimidating because when I started to prepare, because nobody really talks about the Viva at uni. I mean, you know, my supervisors, we had a chat about who I would want to be my examiners, but that's the only thing that we talked about. And I have very good supervisors, you know, I'm not dissing them. But I just think the focus is so much on getting the thesis done, because that itself is such a huge thing that almost the Viva gets forgotten about. And I think, like I say, that's why I think what you're doing is brilliant, because, you know, it gives people this space to ask the questions like we've talked about over the course of the discussion. You know, well, you know, can I write in the Viva? Can I take notes? Can I take a pause? These kind of questions that you might feel silly asking your supervisor. But if there's a space where there's other people who are in the same boat, and there's someone who's gone through it, then I think that's excellent. And I think, yeah, I don't know, maybe I was just kind of procrastinating and stopping myself from starting my new projects. But I think writing the blog post for me was like the kind of final hurdle, if you like. And I wanted to have this resource that could prove useful for other people. And I think since I put those up, I've got more hits on my blog than anything else I've put up there. So I think it clearly has struck a chord with people. You know, so yeah, I think that's probably my answer to your question.
Yeah, no, and there'll be links to those posts in the show notes for this episode. They're really, really great posts.
Thanks.
I mean, they are, like I said, there's such a great amount of detail to them. And I think this is, when you were saying that, like, people don't talk about it, this was my experience during my PhD. Mm-hmm. And then after the PhD, when I came to do this and workshops and things, it came out of the, you know, it wasn't talked about. You know, where I would ask people coming out of their Viva, during my PhD, oh, what happened? Was it okay? And they would really just say, it was fine. Yeah, it was okay. Or, oh, it went by really quickly. And then discussion over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's what I think is really, really great about now. And I really do feel this, that obviously the world has moved on in the last 7 years, but the big change that I see, because of like my own focus for work, is that people are so much more willing to, if they're not talking about the viva in their department or in their institution, there's at least a good and growing number of people who are blogging about it, or who are coming on podcasts, or doing something to share their experience.
Definitely.
We're almost out of time. Just to round things off though, Fiona, is it okay if I ask you the two final questions about advice that you have for people?
Yeah, sure.
Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, what advice would you give someone who was starting a PhD?
That's a tricky one. Can I have a second to think about that? That's a joke.
Yeah.
I'm joking. I think what do I wish I'd done? I think it's difficult because on the one hand, I regret not having more detailed notes of my thoughts over the years, but I think that's quite a difficult thing to track, because obviously it's easy at the end of the PhD to say, oh, if only I'd started with a notebook for each of my chapters and I could have written all the relevant stuff in there. So I think maybe that's a bit kind of unrealistic as a piece of advice. I think maybe the bibliography is probably one of the worst bits to do at the end, because you have to check everything. And I think if you're really disciplined from the start and you take really detailed notes of everything that you're reading and why you think it's useful or not useful, I think that could be a really useful piece of advice, because it lets you go back. I mean, you're still going to have to go back and reread things, because you might have changed your mind about something or find it useful for different reasons. But I think keeping a note of everything you read and your thoughts about it when you've read it is probably a really useful tool. And I mean, I don't know about yourself, but in terms of like software for referencing, I started off using RefWorks and I spent so much time putting information into RefWorks, and then I didn't end up using it at all because it's not very user friendly, I don't think. So I think actually what I wish I had done in that respect was keep a Word document with all my bibliographical information, because then it would have all been in the same place and it would have been formatted and it would have been easy then to edit at the end. I think maybe other people have more knowledge of the software that are out there for referencing. But I think that's something that, you know, it sounds really simple and superficial, but I think, you know, it's something that can save you so much time at the end if you've been disciplined with yourself in terms of keeping a note of everything that you've read and, you know, where the sources were from and whatnot. It's a really boring piece of advice, but... Yeah.
No, I don't think it's boring at all. I think it's a really practical and really good piece of advice, because it's really, this is something I joke about sometimes. Like, I feel really lucky, because I think my bibliography stretches to maybe 61 things, mm-hmm. 61 papers or books or whatever. And I think I routinely sort of talk to people and they say, oh, you know, my bibliography is like 300 odd references and so on. And,
yeah.
It's difficult, you know, and practically speaking, from day one, it would be really good for people to know that this is something to keep on top of.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, however you manage it, it's something that needs doing.
Yeah.
For our last question then today, what advice would you give someone preparing for their viva?
I would say read my blog posts. Shameful, publicity.
That's fine.
I would also say, I mean, I think your book Failure Viva is a really good place to start, because I loved it. I thought it was really lighthearted, which I think is useful, because it's a very stressful time, and I think if people are anxious about it, then, you know, reading something that's really humorous will help alleviate those feelings. So I think, yeah, read about the viva, and there's so many resources out there, like the podcast that you're doing, your book, and I have a list of other sources on one of those blog posts as well that I looked at. You know, and I think talk to people about their audience, which I think a lot of people maybe feel hesitant to do, because it can feel intimidating. But actually, I think if you talk to people, most people will tell you it wasn't as bad as they thought it was going to be. And if that's the one thing that you take away from any conversation with someone who's already done a Viva, then that's a good thing. Yeah, and look for support as well, whatever form that takes. So I think, you know, for me, there was one of my Twitter acquaintances who was also sitting her Viva around about the same time. And, you know, so I spent quite a lot of time messaging her, emailing her, and we kind of shared what we were doing. And she works in something totally different to me. But I think just the fact that we were going through the process together was really comforting. But obviously, you know, for other people, that support might take the form of, I don't know, like going out with friends and not talking about the Viva, or, you know, going to the gym, putting your headphones in and forgetting, you know, whatever it is that you need to get yourself through it, then do it. You know, don't feel bad that you're taking time away from preparing. So yeah, I don't know. Those are a few tips. I think there's lots of things you could do, but those are a few things I think are useful.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing them. And also for everything else we've talked about today. Thank you for giving up some of your time to come and talk to me and to share this with everybody listening.
No problem. Thank you.
That's all for episode 54. Many thanks to Fiona for joining me today and to you for listening. This is the first episode of 2016, so Happy New Year. There'll be lots more episodes of the Viva Survivors podcast in 2016. I have other plans for the podcast. I'm going to try and get this onto iTunes. I'm going to look at expanding the show notes from all the previous episodes. Be exploring Patreon and a way that you can help support the podcast and the production. As ever, if you would like to appear on a future episode of the podcast, then please get in touch either by emailing me podcast@viva-survivors.com, or you can tweet @ViverSurvivors or @DrRyder. Until next time, I'm Nathan Ryder, and thanks for listening.